Welcome to PNC C-Speak, the language of executives. I'm Saskia Epstein, Senior Vice President of PNC Bank in New England, alongside my co-host, Carolyn Jones, Market President and Publisher of the Boston Business Journal.
Thanks, Saskia. It's great to be with you on PNC C-Speak. Each podcast features local executives talking about relevant and timely business topics. This knowledge-sharing platform showcases leaders with forward-thinking approaches that disrupt the status quo and cause us to think differently.
Our guest today is Pratt Wiley, President and CEO of The Partnership, an organization focused on attracting, retaining, and developing professionals of color at all levels of leadership. Thank you so much for joining us, Pratt. Let's start off with a brief overview of The Partnership and its mission.
First of all, thank you all for inviting me here today. The Partnership itself is a leadership development organization based here in Boston, really designed around the twin goals of creating a place of prosperity and belonging. We seek to ensure and enhance the economic competitiveness of initially our city and then our region and now across the country, by helping professionals of color, as well as the companies they work for, reach their full potential.
It's a great organization that has borne many leaders, that's for sure. So Pratt, before coming in as CEO of The Partnership, you've got a really interesting background, but you practiced law, and you also worked in the area of voting rights and registration, obviously a critical topic these days. Talk a little bit about how did that work inform and prepare you for the role that you have now as CEO of The Partnership?
Sure. I'll ramble a little bit, but I think the pieces all fit together. First and foremost, my mom ran this organization when I was a teenager. So I very much grew up in The Partnership. When my mom took over, the organization was nearly bankrupt. And as a result, orientation for our fellows program, which is really our flagship leadership development program for professionals of color at the middle stages of their career. That orientation and many of those sessions were in my parents' living room. And so my exposure, my immersion in this organization and really what it means for people personally really does start at that stage. But I never thought that this is where I would end up. Never thought that I'd be working at the Partnership itself. When I was working in the Obama administration, where I ran voting rights for the Democratic Party, and I would travel all over the country trying to help raise awareness around voting rights and even more so develop strategies and tactics to help ensure that every citizen was able to register and vote and be confident that their vote had been counted. Wherever you find voting rights issues, you tend to find Black and brown communities. And every time I would come back from one of my road trips, regardless of where we were, whether it was in the Midwest, in Ohio, in Wisconsin, in Minnesota, whether it was in the South, whether it was in the Pacific Northwest, I would always, when I would call my mom and let her know that I had gotten back safely from my work trip, say, God, I wish there was something like The Partnership in this city. I wish that there were some mechanism that had connected all of the professionals of color so that we could have conversations about the resources that we needed assistance in securing, that we could have support in communicating the issues that were important to the community, so that we could tap into more effectively the power dynamics within the city. So that was one piece of it, just organizationally. But what I also realized was that the challenges, I'm a native Bostonian, grew up in Brookline, and the challenges, the reputation of Boston, I realized are merited, right? That there are racial tensions in this city that are real. It is not easy to be a person of color in Boston, but it's not unique, and that many of the challenges that we face here in Boston are faced all across the country, and that maybe some of the solutions that we've stumbled upon over the years might also be applicable all across the country. So that was a little bit of my journey. I was a corporate lawyer, never thought I was going to do any of this. You know, thought I was just going to help people start companies and be hopefully a valuable member of the bar. But at some point, I think I need to do something a little bit different.
Talk to us a little bit about the journey of the organization to embrace that national mandate and magnet, as you described it, and how you've managed to stay so locally rooted as well and continue to grow and achieve so much in the local footprint.
Our decision to expand our presence is one that really has occupied the organization for probably 15 years, if not longer. When you look at the companies that we serve, part of why I was brought in is that we have this great collection of anchor clients, those who have been with us in many cases for 20 plus years, who have sent hundreds of participants through our programs. Brands like TJX, right? Marshalls, TJ Maxx, Home Goods, Liberty Mutual, Biogen, National Grid. These are companies that themselves have employees all over the country. And so they are oftentimes looking at the services, they may be based here in Boston, but looking at the opportunities and services to develop their leaders. And in some cases, they were flying talent in for once a month to take part in our programs. Secondly, as much as we've always wanted to retain talent in Boston, that was really one of the major goals of the organization, our very founding, was to help reverse the brain drain that the city started to suffer following the busing crisis. We know that not everyone's going to stay in Boston, right? That there are opportunities all over the country, all over the globe, and that we want our alumni to be able to take advantage of those opportunities. And so if someone has the opportunity to launch a startup and it happens to be in Silicon Valley rather than here in Massachusetts, then so be it. And if that's good enough for Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, then that should also be good enough for folks of color who are starting those opportunities, leveraging those opportunities as well. So we had alumni that were all over the country, and we had clients that were all over the country. And so what we've been able to do over the last several years is, rather than expand and create franchises, if you will, of the partnership all over the country, we really have been able to immerse ourselves in communities where there are already these clusters of participants, and there are mentors and their mentees and alumni, so that we can meet people where they are, both professionally and personally and geographically, and help them get to where they want to go.
Well, I can see why the Boston Business Journal named you one of its 2021 Power 50 Movement Makers, Pratt. That list was comprised of community and business leaders like yourself, whose work is helping to shape a more equitable Boston. Talk to us a little bit more about your movement and the other changes that might be underfoot or that you hope will be.
Yeah, you know, as nice and as humbling as it was to be named on the Power 50 Movement Makers list, what was really the most satisfying to me was the fact that there were 16 other members of just the 2021 list that were also alumni of the partnership programs and member of the partnership community. And to me, that's what makes this award so satisfying, this recognition so satisfying, but what also makes it so, I think, so perfectly named, right? Movement really is the right word, both in scale and within time, right? This isn't about a campaign, right? This isn't about me and what I can do or what the partnership can do. Like, this is really about all of us. And this isn't about a moment in time, but this is really about ensuring that our legacy is one that is benefiting generations to come. And so to be just among so many extraordinary leaders, again, many of whom are themselves products of this organization and our services and our community, it was, again, very exciting. And what is, I think, challenging for me and for my colleagues and for Carolyn is that every year we will be in a position to nominate more than 50 people who are just alumni of the partnership, who are themselves leading these movements and integral to this movement in civic spaces and government and corporate spaces just this last month or so. So we now have the Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, the Attorney General, the U.S. Attorney, as well as the District Attorney. They are all members of this partnership community. And feeling much more comfortable if I get a parking ticket or a speeding ticket. I end up in too much trouble. But it's also just thinking about just in one area, right? One area of law, in one industry, the impact that an organization like this and those that we work alongside can have. And we're having that same impact in education. We're having that same impact in life sciences. We're having that same impact in financial services. And it really is, it's an exciting time to be a Bostonian.
Well, you know, it shows the impact of the partnership, the fact that so many were sort of on our list. And I think the fact that there's lots more out there in many directions we can take it, you know, that's our goal, is to constantly be looking, you know, sort of who those key leaders are, but who else is making a difference. And there's always new folks.
So. Maybe, Carolyn, maybe one day we have in the BBJ, one of our lists are just partnership alumni.
There
you go. I would love to see that in our book of list one year.
Yeah, and if not, Pratt, you just gave Carolyn a pro tip that for next year's Power 50, right, as they're sourcing nominees, they know the list to look at, which is the partnership alumni list.
And that list, the 40 under 40, CFOs, the number of ways that we can be supportive is...
You always give us a great pipeline, which we appreciate.
Yeah.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about you as a leader. And, you know, your mom, as you said, was the first CEO back in 1987. And just pretty neat fact that, you know, now 2019, here you become CEO. Talk a little bit about sort of that connection, you know, how both kind of the learnings, the challenges, and how that interaction with your mom or your experience with it, how that shaped you as a leader.
Yeah. One of the great gifts that my sister and I had in our 20s and 30s, we would almost always be walking down the street of Boston and somebody would stop us and say, I went through the partnership while your mom was running the organization and it changed my life. And certainly as a teenager, the last person that you're ever going to listen to is your mother, except maybe your father, right? And so a lot of this wisdom, this mentorship, this advocacy, this sponsorship that she was so great at giving others was taken for granted by me. And I think I can speak for my sister as well. But we really did grow up in it. We really did grow up in it. One of our key programs here at the partnership is called Efficacy, but you can think of it as resiliency. And I did that as a 12-year-old, 13-year-old, something like that, right? And it completely, to this day, has shaped my founding of how I think about challenges and quote unquote setbacks, right? That failure is simply information, right? And it's not ratification, it's information. And what do you do with it? But it's also about people. And I think that was really what I learned more than anything else from my mom, is that leadership isn't about organizational behavior. It's not about org charts. It's not about balance sheets. It is about people. And what I try to do as a leader, whether it's certainly here at the partnership, but when I was in politics and in government, when I was a practicing attorney, was always try to spend as much time as I could investing in people. And you never know, right? You never know what that person is going through. You never know where they are in their journey. You never know what part of a conversation may be helpful. But certainly, it never hurts to let people know that you're there, that you've got an ear for them to bend. And if you're someone like me who has benefited from having a tremendous depth and wealth of mentors, and I can pass along what I've learned from that collective wisdom to others, then you're doing something right, right? You're doing something right. And that has, again, that served me well in every role that I've had as a professional.
Well, Pratt, among other things, your story is giving me hope as a parent of two teenagers who are not inclined to follow in my footsteps or those of their father. So thank you for that.
Honestly, Saskia, it was like one day, one of my mentors in the legal field, Mo Cowan.
Yes.
Many people know now, but, you know, as he's you know, a U.S. senator and leader in law and government and business. But when I was first applying to law school, first thinking about law school, Mo was one of the people who he was still a leader in law at the time that I reached out to. And I credit him with so much of where I have ended up over the years. And one time he did say, you know, I'm just parroting the advice that I got from your folks. Right? But the messengers matter, right?
It took me about
20 years to figure it out. But I got there.
Well, the seeds of your career may have started when you were 12, but you certainly went on to carve your own path. And with the advice of Mo and your parents and others, many other mentors, I'm sure. I'd love to hear a little bit more about some of the markers of that career journey and the moments that were pivotal in shaping who you are as a leader, how you think about your leadership style and the experiences that influenced your success.
I mean, there's a lot. I mean, we've got all day. I would still have more of those markers than we would have time for. But there are a couple that really do stand out. One was from my boss and mentor, Bob Bauer. And we had just come off of the 2012 campaign or the reelection campaign for President Obama. And I had quit my job at Nutter McLennan to go work on this campaign. And I was trying to decide, what do I want to do next? I could come back to Boston. I could practice law. I could move to DC and join a law firm. I could stay in Chicago. I didn't really quite know what I wanted to do, but did want to at least explore opportunities in the administration. And Bob asked me a really simple question. And he said, there isn't a right or a wrong answer, other than you have to be 100% honest with yourself. But there is no right or wrong answer. And when you're thinking about a job in the administration, which is more important to you? Do you want to be a paper pusher, but you know exactly how many paces away from the Oval Office you are? Or do you want to work someplace where you have a tremendous impact, but no one may ever see it? And I probably spent 3 seconds thinking about it. And for me, the answer was the second category. And he just sort of chuckles and he says, I already knew your answer, right? And this is the job, right? We want you to run voting rights across the country. We want you to help make this a practice area of law and really make it a key component of Democratic campaigns moving forward. And that question has guided me, honestly, in everything I have done for the last, it was probably 10 years ago, right about now. It was right before the president was re-inaugurated in 2013, right? And it's been just so important for how the decisions that I've made and then the decisions and the guidance I give others. Another piece of advice, and this is one that I got probably, as a 12-year-old, right? Rena Clark, who was a member of Partnership Community and helped found the organization and graduate of Harvard Business School, her advice was essentially, feel free, give yourself permission to zag when everyone else is zigging. Right. You have to have the confidence to build your own course and to collect the different tools and resources and experiences that you'll need in order to be successful. But give yourself permission to zag when everyone else is zigging. And I've certainly have done a lot of that. If you look at my resume, you're just like, what on earth? what has this guy been doing?
Yeah,
it makes a lot more sense than perhaps you're giving yourself credit for. But I love the expression of zigging when people are zagging or vice versa.
Yeah.
It's a great takeaway.
And it's hard to do. It is really hard to do to have that confidence because you're always, what don't I know? And especially if you're a person of difference, you're already thinking, oh, I have smaller margin of error, but I have never gone wrong by at least looking at those moments to zag.
Important. That takes a lot of confidence too. Really does. Which takes time to build up as well. So Pratt, you know, as you, like everyone, has experienced these last 2+ years that have really impacted business, how we do business, our community on so many levels. How would you frame those challenges? How have they kind of shifted perhaps or influenced how you look at things both in business, running your organization, and then in the community over the long term?
In 2022, where we had this moment, right, going back to movements versus moments, and when everyone was focused on this racial reckoning conversation, and I think were and are sincere in examining both its causes, its effects, and exploring remedies. One piece that was very important to me was that we never forget how truly persistent and resistant systemic racism is. Right? And going back to just Saskia's question about what did I learn in voting rights? I had a chance to help organize a number of celebrations around the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act in 2015. And it was beautiful. I mean, it was inspiring. We went back to Selma. We got to work with freedom writers. I got a chance to be on multiple panels with John Lewis and talk about this work. And all of it was exciting and humbling. But it was also depressing that 50 years after this moment, right, 50 years after this legislation, 50 years after the tremendous political courage of President Johnson to even advocate for the Voting Rights Act, that I still had a job as the director of voter protection and voter expansion, that we were continuing to see new ways that states and parties on both sides, but the parties were manipulating our electoral system to disenfranchise entire communities. So that persistence and that resistance of systemic racism is something that cannot be overestimated. And so that's something that I think has really helped shape the way that we at the partnership have then helped lead discussions around best practices and solutions that both leaders, professionals and executives of color, and their organizations can adopt to ensure that we're making progress, that we don't just simply check a box, ensure that the hard work, the difficult questions and discussions, and the sometimes painful decisions become part of our muscle memory. Just as it's hard for us to make a budget every year, right, and to set priorities and mean that other things are not going to be prioritized, we need to do that hard work around culture as well. And that's the way that we think about DE&I at the partnership. It really is about corporate culture, right? And it's about creating corporate cultures that can best attract and leverage the talent to help you win.
If we take that just one step further, that topic, what are some of the things you're most optimistic about? And conversely, what are some of the things that really worry you?
So the first thing that I'm really optimistic about is we are seeing some companies that have really changed. There's a whole new perspective in how they look at diversity, inclusion, belonging. It has become part of their DNA. And we have more than 500 companies that we've worked with over our 35 years. And you are starting to see companies cluster themselves in different parts of the spectrum. And on one end of the spectrum, there were those companies that put out a press release and a really heartfelt statement after the murder of George Floyd, and then maybe did something else a couple of months later and have now said, well, you know, I think we're going to prioritize our core business objectives from here on out. And then there are others that have really have embraced that diversity, equity, inclusion is really a pathway to belonging, and that belonging is a pathway to prosperity and thriving, and that it is a core business objective, and that the hard conversations are only bad when they stop being hard or when they stop being had, right? It's exciting to see. And I think that's part of why you're seeing this whole new generation of leaders of color assuming roles throughout the city, throughout the region, and really throughout the country, because people have really committed to having these tough conversations and then making the tough decisions as a result of it.
You highlighted that you've seen some companies really change. And I'm certain that any CEO or business leader listening to this is asking out loud, how did they do that? So how would you respond? What are some of the things that corporate leaders can and should be doing and the business community at large to help make Boston more equitable and accessible for all?
So there isn't a one-size-fits-all response to this, but there are a couple of common threads. And one common thread is it starts at the top. It really does start at the top. When a CEO, board chair, and the board themselves are themselves invested in change, for lack of a better word, but certainly invested in this work of creating more equitable and accessible spaces, just as a company where a CEO is focused on operational efficiency, just as a company where the CEO is focused on transformation, just as in a company where a CEO is focused on financial results, when the CEO is focused on this, it really does have a tremendous impact. And so for every CEO who has over the last couple of years hired a chief diversity officer or someone along those lines, that's not the ending of the process, it's the beginning. And just as you hire a CFO, it doesn't mean that you're a CEO not still responsible for the financial health of an organization. If you hire a CDO, you're still responsible for the cultural health of your organization. And so I think that is lesson number one. Lesson number two is, and this is a big piece of what we talk about the partnership all the time, is part of the challenge that we see is not that there is the absence of talent of color, but rather the networks are disconnected. And so if leaders, especially at the CEO level, but leaders at anyone in the C-suite who take the time to meet with, engage in, and build out their networks of professionals and executives of color, you're going to very quickly realize that there is a tremendous amount of untapped talent, or at least untapped to you talent that's available to you. And I think a great example of both of these lessons are actually our outgoing governor, Governor Baker. Coming into office, he was following Deval Patrick, right? So he already had, I think, some skepticism within the communities of color of just, well, you know, like we had our first governor of color, and now there's this tall white dude coming in. What are we going to see? And not only did Governor Baker continue and really push forward through to completion what's now the Massport model and really dramatically changing policies in terms of how diversity is thought about and having diversity and equity be part of evaluations for real estate development. But when you look at who he surrounded himself with, the governor, who he appointed, and how that pipeline of diverse talent grew over his 8 years in office, much of it is, it was not him saying, well, I really want to appoint somebody here who is Latinx or somebody here who is Black, but I have a much broader and more diverse talent of people that I know and who I've been able to really assess and test. And now from this pool, I can really pick the people who I want. And when they are people of color or people of difference, it's all the better. But that's not where he starts. It's part of how he added to the process. And so I think if the governor of Massachusetts is able to make this type of change, especially when he had the political environment that he had, I think those of us who are executives in organizations can recognize that there are far fewer institutional barriers for us than there were for him. And I think that gives us some encouragement.
Some exciting times ahead in the State House with a diverse group.
And it's all the better right now. Yeah. Now we have even more diversity in the governor's office. And who would have guessed that Governor Healey, that the bar is going to be pretty high for her to continue to have diverse administrations. And she's meeting that standard so far.
You talked a lot about sort of the diversity piece being such a key part of a company and their culture and those that really make that part of the fabric. Talent and retention is one of the top things on every executive's list these days, finding talent, keeping talent. How do you do that? What insights can you share both from your own leadership at the partnership, but also the things that the partnership teaches? What can you share with us about how to create a great employee experience and culture and maintain it?
This is me being the beneficiary of great mentors myself during the very beginning part of the Great Resignation and talking about what we were seeing and me having conversations with folks who were making those transitions and he looking at it from a more macro perspective. And he observed that folks are really asking themselves three questions. They want to know, do I love what I do, who I do it with, and who I do it for? And that generationally, the three of us would have asked two questions, at least two of those three questions. And if we had an answer to probably one of them, we would have been happy. I would have just asked a third one. Are they paying me? And then let me know, just point me in the right direction. But do I love what I do? Do I love who I'm doing it for? Do I love who I'm doing it with? And when any of the answers was no, then people started to look elsewhere. During this great resignation, it wasn't really a great resignation. It was a great reshuffling, right? People weren't just simply retiring off to the beach. They were either finding new opportunities or they were creating opportunities of their own. And they still are. As a manager, I think being very sensitive to those questions is important. Understanding how your team, your reports will answer those questions are important. And it doesn't mean that it's Disneyland every day. But if somebody is feeling that they are in a position where they can continue to grow and be challenged, they are able to be themselves and respected by their colleagues, and they have a pride in the work they do and the clients they serve, that makes a big difference. That makes a real big difference. And taking the time to have those conversations, either very explicitly and sort of go through the questionnaire or perhaps less so, but really have a conversation about where people are and where they want to be and how they are engaging with those around them, I think is critically important. Here in the region, we've been suffering from losing nursing staff at unprecedented levels and the strain that that has put on our healthcare system and the strain that that has in turn put on the finances of the hospitals and the systems themselves. And there's all sorts of reasons why nurses are leaving the profession at higher rates than ever before, right? Not the least of which is this global pandemic and the different waves that seem to just never stop. But we would be foolish to ignore the other piece of the equation, which is that the number of incidents, violence or harassment within hospitals and towards nursing staff in particular, but staff all around, is also at unprecedented levels. And so you can look at a smaller organization like the partnership or large organizations like our hospital systems and see how tending to that quality, people loving what they do and who they do it with and who they're doing it for, will have a huge impact on certainly retention. And retention to us is really the key to recruiting. The single best tool you have to bring in new talent, especially talent of color, is having folks there who are thriving and who are happy to tell other folks to come join us.
Sure. I feel like we're in a speed mentoring session, Carolyn. We're getting a taste of what I think is probably the wisdom and teaching embedded in your curriculum. And thank you so much for that. We've talked a little about the change that is underfoot, and you just highlighted some of the challenges that many industries are facing, not just healthcare with nurses, but education with teachers. And I'm sure there are many other professions as well. As we look ahead a bit further to the next generation of executives and leaders and the next generation too of companies, technology and discoveries, what do you think the future holds for our city?
It's such a great question. It really is a great question. And if I were able to predict the future, I probably wouldn't be working at a nonprofit. in my ditch someplace, right?
I'd say you're very well positioned, actually. Right. With
but I'll use the recent past as a way to hopefully predict the near-term future. There are, again, a number of high-profile, highly important leaders of color who have assumed positions in the last, really just the last 3 years, right? We're actually planning a dinner for CEOs of color who moved to the city during the pandemic. And the guest list keeps getting longer and longer, which is great, which is really
great. That's wonderful.
But if we look at where I'm sitting right now in the Seaport, and we look at the life science industry, it's just two examples of an industry and a space that have just absolutely exploded over the last 15 years. I think we can all recognize that we did not embed DE&I. We did not contemplate systemic racism as we were thinking about how we could best position the growth, the explosion within these industries, right, and within these spaces. And so if I'm just thinking about artificial intelligence, right, and all I know about artificial intelligence is what I read in the newspapers, right? I haven't even played around with it myself at all. But can this region, with its leaders and its changing face, and being a real leader in this conversation about equity and accessibility, can it help shape an AI future where systemic racism isn't embedded in the formula? Can it help lead a future where health equity, as well as wealth equity, as well as educational equity, are all maybe not completely solved? I don't think we're ever going to solve it in our lifetimes, but certainly where those gaps have been closed across the board so that we become a model for others in the country and the world, right? Like one piece that has been really illuminating for just us at the partnership, our most recent class that just completed their programs in December, we were in 11 different countries. And so we very much focus on the experience of being a person of color in the US. And we anticipated that it would be analogous in Canada and in the UK and a couple of other places. But we have people from China and from India also participating because these challenges are real and they're uniform. And so these opportunities for this next generation of leaders to not just react to a challenge after it has already been baked into the cake, but to really think critically about those ingredients at the very beginning, that is going to be the transformative moment. And we might never actually know of it, right? It will be the absence of a problem. So we might not ever really think about it or know of it. But that is, to me, that's the moonshot. That's the game changer. And that's the opportunity for this next generation of leaders, right, to not just continue to change opinions office by office, department by department, company by company, but to really shape industries in ways that would have been unthinkable before.
Thank you so much for that. That's a powerful charge and a great note to end on. But before we do, we like to close with some rapid fire questions. This is truly off the top of your head.
Okay.
So sort of speed round, Pratt, what are you currently reading or watching or listening to other than C-Speak?
So I am a devoted C-Speak listener. Two books. One, Born a Crime. I just finished that over the weekend. Trevor Noah's memoir. And just, I was feeling the withdrawals of him leaving the Daily Show. And I was like, you know what? This book has been sitting on my bookshelf for a long time. Let me read that. And it was so good. It was so good. And then a book that both my mom and I are reading, and we're going to do a little comparison, Horse by Geraldine Brooks, who is, she lives on Martha's Vineyard. She's not too far away from where my folks are. And so we're counting her as a local author. I think she's won a couple of Pulitzers, but we're just counting her as a local author.
Great. I know a lot of our listeners are going to be picking up that book just so that they can join your family book club. Pratt, we've talked a lot about leaders, and you've very generously shared with some of us who your mentors have been. Who are the Boston leaders or an organization that you are watching?
So I think all eyes are going to be on Tanisha Sullivan this year, as well as Michael Curry. Tanisha is the president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP. Mike is a member of the national board of the NAACP. And as the convention comes to town, finally, I think most of us are very much looking forward to showing the nation who we are and surprising them of what they find here. Another is Sadal Neely. Sadal is a professor at Harvard Business School. Sadal is one of the leaders in organizational behavior as well as digital transformation. She's also a member of our board here at the partnership. And as we all collectively are figuring out what the new normal is, I don't know anybody who has thought about this more and what it means and the challenges to leadership than Sadal. Damon Hart, who is an executive at Liberty Mutual. He's the new chief legal officer at Liberty Mutual and one of the founding members of the new Commonwealth Fund for racial equity. We're all very, very pleased with Damon and his leadership. One last person that I just think would be very timely, and that's Amari Jeffries. And if folks haven't had a chance to go visit the Embrace Boston Common, I really hope that they take the time to do so.
Great call out. What is a favorite spot in the city, in addition perhaps to the Embrace Memorial?
Right. My favorite spot in the city is walking up Park Street towards the State House. My favorite true space, like my real happy space, is the Boston Athenaeum.
Hidden treasure. Love that.
Can't beat that. Can't beat that.
All right. Well, you are a serious guy doing serious work, and this conversation has been serious too, but I know you also laugh a lot. What makes you laugh?
If it is inappropriate, it makes me laugh. Right?
Well, I guess it's good that we skipped over those parts of the conversation.
Right. My girlfriend has a 4-year-old nephew, and so I can make him laugh with making inappropriate bodily function sounds.
I was going to say, body humor is really big with the 4-year-olds.
Right, exactly. And then, you know, anything like Trevor Noah or folks who are, you know, stand-up comedy. I love stand-up. It's my favorite art form.
And finally, Pratt, a wish for Boston.
You know, I just hope, sort of tying a bow on this, I really hope that Boston, in its tradition of being first in so many important areas, is the first city, the first region where no matter who you are or where you're from, you know that when you come here, you can be yourself and you can reach your full potential.
Beautiful sentiment. Thank you so much, Pratt, for joining us on this episode of PNCC Speak. We loved having you here.
Thank you.
And that wraps up another episode. Thank you so much for joining us, Pratt, and for sharing your insights. I'm Saskia Epstein.
And I'm Carolyn Jones, and this is PNC C-Speak, the language of executives. Until next time. You've been listening to PNC C-Speak, the language of executives. This podcast and other engaging episodes can be found at bizjournals.com/Boston. Search PNC. Come back soon and join us for another PNC C-Speak.